Our History, We Made It Happen, by Werewolves Are Real, read by Marianas.
It is entirely unacceptable.
I hardly see why, Persythia protests.
The public outrage, the spectacle, they could have scandalized any number of children.
Were there any children about?
Lord Atterbury puffs up.
That is quite beside the point.
I would not say so if your argument hinges on the presence of children. Although, Persidia adds, I do not see what children have to do with the matter at all. It is not as though Minnow and Belusa can make any eggs.
Atterbury sputters. Can I ask why you came here? Asks Lawrence with the tired demeanor of one who doesn't really expect an answer.
Temerar's pavilion is coming along quite well. It's hardly unusual to see dragons of all shapes and sizes stopping by to speak with him about this issue or that. Some of the callers come with social visits in mind, but Temerar's status in Parliament also gives him a certain allure. Many, like Persythia today, come by the clearing to broach political topics. Of course, Temerar is currently helping Tharkay's tenants clear a fallen bridge, so Lawrence, unfortunately, is the only one here to listen to Persythia's complaints.
It is not proper, says Atterbury, and swallows suddenly.
Some politicians still have a habit of abruptly recalling that they are, in fact, arguing with a many-ton beast that could swallow them whole. Not that any British dragon would do such a thing.
It is not proper, he repeats. We cannot create an exception for dragons. It sets a poor example for the whole of the nation. Indeed, it is worse for a dragon to commit such crimes, as the scale of the act makes it impossible to ignore.
Well, that just seems rude, says Persythia severely.
Atterbury turns to Lawrence.
Captain, he appeals. Lawrence shifts from one foot to another. He is technically retired.
Surely, you must understand. I agreed to come here in the hopes that you could help the creatures see reason.
Sir, he says. If I may, I think the example in this instance must only serve to show you that these intimate acts were perfectly natural. A dragon has no concept that there is anything wrong with their urges, and indeed, I do not see how any instinctual behaviors can be condemned when clearly these inclinations were created without any outside interference.
Unlike dragon breeding, he thinks, but does not say. He rather disapproves of arranged breedings more than this, even if the dragons themselves have never seemed to mind.
I do not understand how, as a Christian man, you could defend such a thing. Atterbury says, and such generalizations.
The Lord stops abruptly.
Sir?
Lawrence turns to follow Atterbury's gaze.
Tharkay is winding his way over to the pavilion, his walk slow and easy. He's wearing a fine light coat that Lawrence has often noted for its ability to throw his eyes into striking relief, and he carries an entirely unnecessary diamond-tipped cane. It makes pretentious lords grit their teeth and never fails to please the dragons. For a moment, Lawrence wonders if Atterbury is one of the number offended by Tharkay's recent inclusion into the aristocracy.
You live here on Mr. Tharkay's good graces, do you not?
Atterbury says abruptly.
And that dragon, too. A kindness, I am sure. A prodigious favor for anyone. Well, I do see. I do see.
Lawrence frowns.
Sir?
Atterbury shakes his head.
Get me away from here. He demands of Persythia. I have business, more important business, than the affairs of amorous dragons. We can discuss this later.
You could at least be a bit more polite, she sniffs, but extends her leg nevertheless. A moment later, the pair rise into the sky.
Lawrence stares after them with a very slow sense of understanding.
Tharkay finally reaches the pavilion.
Temerar has sent a message saying he will be late. Has something happened?
Possibly, Lawrence sighs.
I dare say we will know as soon as anyone else, if so.
The atmosphere of Tharkay's Scotland Manor is wholly different from any other place Lawrence has known. There are, by necessity, servants. Any building with some 3 dozen rooms can scarcely be kept in good repair without help. But these 2 or 3 workers are quiet and unobtrusive, by incident or design Lawrence does not know. In the mornings, he rises and fetches his food with Tharkay, and they go out to Temerar's pavilion to break their fast as the sun rises on its endless path. Temerar has employed his own cooks. He declined Tharkay's offer of finding men, explaining that he enjoys employing people who will certainly remain and be his.
Indeed, he eyes the workers with a certain satisfaction today as he compliments them on the flavor of their fatted cow. Today, though, Lawrence has some news. He clears his throat while Tharkay finishes his own breakfast. "I have accepted a position with the Foreign Office. A diplomatic position," he says, belatedly. His face heats without reason. Tharkay is putting down his fork, no hint of an expression on his face.
"Oh, how excellent!" Temeraire exclaims. "That sounds quite interesting, Lawrence."
Tharkay, though, eyes him. "Are you not concerned that the office means to abuse your status as a prince, Lawrence? You cannot negotiate with the Chinese on an even footing." Of course Lawrence has thought of this already.
"Oh, they would try to trick you," Temeraire says, already outraged.
Lawrence forestalls him. "I have made it a condition that I will not deal with China, nor any of their protectorates," he says. "I believe they intend to reach out to Japan in the upcoming months. France has, and it would not do for us to fall behind in diplomatic relations."
"I dare say Japan will be rethinking that particular alliance," Tharkay comments.
"Still, are you certain about this?"
"Very much so."
"Oh, and where will you be?" Temeraire realizes. Anticipating the Celestial's reaction, Lawrence replies that there is a subsection of the embassy in Edinburgh, and Temeraire exclaims, "Then we may fly to the city together, Lawrence!"
Temeraire stops by the city each morning for any news regarding his parliamentary duties. He visits London regularly, but he will only stay to spend his nights in nearby Dover when Parliament sits in session.
"I do look forward to it," Lawrence says, "and to some activity."
"Yes," Tharkay murmurs, still frowning a little.
"I suppose you must have been bored."
In truth, Lawrence has found himself surprisingly content on the pleasant estate, surrounded by good company and long quiet. But he answers,
"We are neither of us accustomed to inactivity, Tenzing."
Tharkay inclines his head mutely. Lawrence hesitates for just one moment. A question rises to his throat, but then Temeraire leans down further, and the moment passes.
"Oh, do tell me more," the dragon says.
"And then when we go to London next week," Temeraire adds, "we can tell Persaitia all about how you are important again and not a useless figurehead prince at all."
Lawrence ignores the last remark in favor of asking,
"We are going to London?"
"Yes, of course. So, did I not mention," Temeraire seems unabashed,
"a courier came from your brother?"
"By horse," Temeraire seems slightly affronted. "I do not know why he did not ask one of the dragons around his property to deliver it. I will have a word with them. In any case, he has asked us to Nottinghamshire for a night, and I thought we might stop by London, too. Persaitia has been raging about Wellington and how very stupid he is being towards his wife, so perhaps she will want us to help with that."
"I do not think he nor Lady Catherine would appreciate the interference," Lawrence interjects hastily. "Only a dragon would consider a stop by London from Nottinghamshire a worthwhile endeavor."
"Lord Wellington does not appreciate many of the good things we have done, but of course things always work out better once we have done them," Temeraire replies reasonably.
So Lawrence sighs as the dragon slants himself down towards the glowing city of Edinburgh, the distant pinprick houses shining steadily larger as they approach. Temeraire deposits him down the block from the Foreign Office and departs without ceremony. Lawrence pauses to adjust his windswept coat, ignoring stares from a passing gentleman, frozen up in the street and clutching a briefcase, and walks up into the building. A woman with a deep red blush coloring her cheeks sweeps past him with a glower. She has to struggle momentarily to get her overlarge dress through the entrance. Lawrence steps aside and holds the door open, awkwardly, as she huffs and finally yanks through, gripping swathes of fabric.
"Thank you, Your Grace," says a pleasant voice from a desk nearby. "Have an excellent morning."
As soon as the woman is out of sight, the young man sighs and leans back, shaking his head. Lawrence approaches.
"Excuse me," he begins.
"Oh, not again," the man says. "If you are here about that business with the wool trade, the deal is done, and..."
"I beg your pardon," Lawrence interjects firmly. "My name is William Lawrence," and at once the man springs to his feet.
"Mr. Lawrence, Prince Lawrence!"
Lawrence opens his mouth to object.
"Yes, of course, right this way, please, my apologies."
Exasperated, Lawrence follows behind the fumbling assistant. "The director will be with you with a moment, an honor, sir." The aide leads Lawrence into a neat office, where he sits, tugging at an uncustomed civilian suit.
"Quite an honor."
With a bow, the man disappears back through the door. Lawrence stares for a moment, sighs, and leans back. He only has a moment to gaze around the room before the door opens again, and he rises.
"Prince Lawrence, how very good to meet you."
An older gentleman wearing a short white wig shakes his hand.
"Just Mr. Lawrence, please," he repeats tiredly.
"And you are?"
"Clifford Longstaff, and I suspect we will be working together very much," which Lawrence thinks is a subtle way of saying that Longstaff will be giving him directions.
"I'm afraid that my exact duties have not been clearly defined."
"Oh, that is no mistake, Mr. Lawrence. Your history with the Japanese will be invaluable to us. However, I'm afraid we would still have you better versed in the language and culture before working with anyone directly." Longstaff gestures at the desk. It's covered in neat piles of papers. Scrolls with slanted calligraphy, a bit reminiscent of the Chinese style, but plainly not the same, cover one side. The other half is piled with slim books.
"You would do us a good service by translating those books, and I dare say by that point you'll be much better prepared to deal with the embassy when they arrive."
Lawrence sighs a little, but no one had said that this position would be pleasant.
"Very well, then."
"Excellent." Longstaff picks up the thickest book, a reddish monster nearly a foot long. "I would suggest taking notes, sir."
"You are becoming a regular polyglot," Tharkay says, leaning against the wall. "How many languages is this now?"
"I do not like to think about it," Lawrence admits. He taps one of the main books spread out on the parlor table. "French, Mandarin, Dursag, and he can manage a little Russian now. I dearly hope it will not take so long to learn as the Chinese language."
"It seems odd that they would request a diplomat with no skill in the language."
Lawrence has had the same misgivings, but he only says, "Tenzing."
Tharkay raises his hands.
"But that is your business," he says innocently. "If you can be spared from the books for a minute, however."
"Yes, I think so," Lawrence says quickly. Tharkay's lips twitch suspiciously. He offers a mocking bow and gestures for Lawrence to follow him. They proceed down to a small room that Lawrence barely recognizes. Hardly unusual, he often keeps to his own quarters, the dining area, and the library, for those times when Temeraire is being exceptionally finicky. Tharkay seems to have made some new use of the space. Within the last few weeks, maps and scrolls have come to cover every spare inch of desk space, neatly lining the surfaces with the sort of pragmatic orderliness which Lawrence will always associate with Tharkay. A compass and quill rest on one corner of the largest table, centerfold in the room, and his chest gives a painful lurch.
"You're planning a trip?"
"Presently, no. But I'm sure we will have the opportunity for travel eventually, and I know that Temeraire has always wanted to see the Americas. That was not what I wanted to discuss, however." From underneath the chair, he pulls out a box. Lawrence accepts it, still struggling to place his feelings, and opens the lid. It occurs to Lawrence, irreverently but not without cause, that it has been an age since someone handed him a good coat, unadorned by gems or gold or piping. He touches one sleeve of the fabric with bewilderment. Deep blue. It's been years since he's worn blue.
"Why?"
Tharkay shrugs, as though the matter is inconsequential.
"It isn't.
You don't have much suited to civilian life. Good finery, to be sure, and uniforms. But are we not due for a change?"
Lawrence is silent for a moment.
"You have been more than generous to have us here in your home," he begins. "But, Tenzing, I cannot accept a gift for which I can offer no possible compensation."
"I will stop you," Tharkay says flatly. "If you consider yourself a guest, well, I would disabuse you of the notion now. We have been through more than that. Do not do me the disservice of thinking anything less. And as for this pittance," he gestures, "I can have no better compensation than your company and your friendship, which I hope I presume to hold."
"Always, of course."
"Then you will do me a favor and stop insulting me," Tharkay says. "Put it away now. Perhaps we could discuss travel after all. What are your thoughts on Egypt?"
Lawrence thinks about Tharkay's gift for longer, perhaps, than the occasion seems to warrant. But he cannot believe Tharkay does anything without reason, without deliberation. Does he think that Lawrence intends to go somewhere? Is the gift a symbol? Some strange entreaty to stay? But no, he's missing something. And in any case, he and Temeraire have not indicated any desire to leave. The next day, he walks outside with Tharkay while Temeraire shows them new plans for his pavilion.
"So, you see, they are like any chandeliers, but through this mechanism I can light them myself. It is very clever, I think. Timurer holds the bark-bound parchment, deliberately made for draconic claws, with utmost delicacy, as he presents a merchant's neat illustrations.
It will make parties much easier at night, though I do quite like the Chinese lanterns, too.
He tucks away the parchment with a satisfied air. Tharkay is watching the dragon fondly, a faint smile curving at the edges of his lips.
Lawrence, Tamarair says, you said earlier we were going to read. Did you bring the book?
Tharkay turns toward him. Lawrence blinks.
Yes, my dear, of course.
He finds it and joins Tamarair. They sit outside in the sun. There is no need for the direct shelter of the pavilion on its high slope in this weather. Tamarair sinks against the grass and Lawrence rests against his foreleg when he reads. It's an easy pattern, a familiar habit. He has been in the same curved hollow 1,000 times before, and the same words of Temera's beloved Principia Mathematica fall away without a thought, even if Lawrence understands almost none of them. But Lawrence declares himself finished at midday, to Temera's great disappointment, and when he stands, shoulders aching, he notices that Tharkay is still sitting by a nearby tree. He cannot help but think it odd that the man has not ventured closer, until he notices a quill and rolls of parchment scattered around the ground.
Are you writing letters? He asks, surprised into tactlessness.
Tharkay glances at him and begins to gather his supplies. No, he says, and for a moment Lawrence thinks that will be his only reply. Then, after a moment, Tharkay walks closer. He hands over the topmost parchment.
Why, Tensing, I had no idea you were an artist, Lawrence exclaims in genuine pleasure.
The sketch depicts he and Temeraire, both with their heads bent over the book, Temeraire's huge body wraps around Lawrence in the noontime light. I am not. It is one skill of many.
You do yourself no credit. Look, Temeraire.
Too late, Lawrence thinks that perhaps Tharkay would not want the picture shared, but Temeraire is already leaning closer with interest. Then the Celestial huffs.
Why, it is all wrong, he reproaches.
Lawrence exclaims, Temeraire! And Tharkay stiffens.
Well, it is, Temeraire maintains. Look, there's Lawrence, and myself, and the hill nearby, but where are you, Tharkay? The picture is not complete without you.
Lawrence hesitates. He runs his hand over the edge of the parchment, the empty spaces. You are quite right, he admits slowly, and risks a glance up. There is an interminable pause.
Then I must correct it, I suppose, Tharkay says stiffly.
After a beat, he takes back the parchment and joins Lawrence on the grass. When nothing else is forthcoming, Lawrence picks up his book and starts reading again after all.
I understand, Lawrence says patiently. However, I have heard Mr. Wilthorpe say that the Japanese delegation are already in Edinburgh. Surely it would only be appropriate to greet them and...
No, no, Mr. Lawrence. Mr. Lawrence, you are in no way prepared. And I will not be prepared, Lawrence says, if you refrain from telling me anything at all about the embassy or the delegation or their purpose here.
All in good time, Longstaff assures. Lawrence narrows his eyes. I am sorry, Mr. Lawrence, but we are busy.
Lawrence bows his head stiffly as Longstaff hurries away. The office is silent. As far as Lawrence can tell, no one at all has visited today. And, as though just to contradict the thought, he hears a sudden commotion in the hall.
Miss Nastasia, I must continue to insist. We can offer you no assistance. And as no one else can offer me assistance either, I will continue to come back until you find me someone who can.
A shrill voice fumes. Lawrence frowns at the door, curious but unwilling to pry, until he hears,
Miss Nastasia, I'm afraid none of our staff are available to speak with you, and really, we are quite busy.
A bit exasperated, Lawrence shuts yet another Japanese book on etiquette and goes into the hallway. I beg your pardon, he calls. He's startled to see the familiar red-faced woman from a few days before.
Lady Nastasia, perhaps I could be of assistance.
Thank you, she snaps, and marches right past the front clerk.
The man is glaring at him. Lawrence frowns again and follows Nastasia back into his office. She speaks without waiting for him.
I will not be ignored again, Mr. Whoever you are, she says. I do not care what your policies are or what your superiors have said. I know very well when I am being ignored.
Perhaps you could begin by telling me why you are being ignored, he suggests. I confess I have received no orders whatsoever regarding your situation. In fact, I am wholly ignorant. I must ask you why you are here.
I am here about an inheritance, a land dispute. This is hardly the place for land disputes, Lawrence points out gently.
It was not I who took the matter to your office, Mr.
Lawrence.
Mr. Lawrence, I have been continually directed here. My mother was Polish, and that is being used as an excuse, a very thin excuse, for men to take my father's lands away from me. Until the Foreign Office supports my claim, you can continue to expect my presence.
Lawrence hesitates, taps his desk. I doubt the Foreign Office will help you, he admits. Nastasia opens her mouth indignantly. However, if I may suggest several very excellent solicitors, I believe I know a pair with experience in these matters. The evening is falling into night. Purple streaks are deepening into the first coils of black, revealing shots of white stardust in the sky. One dark shadow on the grounds makes a notable blot against this backdrop. Temerer, difficult to see in the night, evidently not yet prepared to find the safety of his pavilion. Lawrence rests his hand briefly against the window before returning to his chair. Tharkis sits opposite him with a glass of wine. One thing I do not miss about nights on the road, he comments, with a slight jerk of his head toward the fire, is the cold. Though the drafts in this old place can sometimes trick the mind, he notes wryly. Perhaps it is the fire, or the wine, that makes Lawrence ask. What would you most like to do, if we were to travel again? Tharkay says nothing for a moment. Do you know that I have no mementos? He says. I have been to more countries than I can count, more than I can likely remember, including several places of uncertain boundaries and names, and yet I have nearly nothing to show for it. I have rooms to fill in this house now. Lawrence considers this. What would you fill them with? Perhaps rocks. That is not quite the answer he was expecting. Rocks, he repeats. Tharkay smiles a little. You would be astonished, Will, at how many varieties of rocks exist. How different they are from one place to another, and at different elevations. A rock can tell the history of a place. It would be a certain task to catalogue the rocks of every place I visit. If you would enjoy it, says Lawrence doubtfully. But he remembers Tharkay tracking an egg through Australia, through thousands of miles of untouched land, inspecting the underbrush and the dirt. Well, what does Lawrence know? It is hardly as though the house will suffer from my eccentricities, Tharkay adds. I have little doubt that Temerer will accumulate enough riches to scandalize 3 households. Lawrence laughs. Lawrence leaves Temerer playing with his brother's 5 children, chatting cheerfully while they climb over his legs. It is odd to walk into Wollaton Hall and feel like a stranger again. Odder still to think that he is so far from Tharkay, but the man insisted on staying behind. His brother's wife, Elizabeth, vanishes quickly after a perfunctory greeting. George seems strangely anxious. Perhaps the library, he says. Lord Allendale always invited his sons into the library when he had bad news, as though the ability to gaze around at the book titles could somehow lessen a situation's awkwardness. Lawrence only agrees. Whatever the real reason for his invite, because clearly George has some purpose for inviting him to Nottinghamshire, he does not seem eager to divulge it. I pray that you have been well, he starts instead. Your letters have started to become rare, Will. Lawrence is aware that this is true. We are all well. Temerer has been learning a great deal for his new position. And so am I, he adds, belatedly realizing he hasn't had time to write to George about his own new posting. He explains about the Foreign Office in Edinburgh, which distracts his brother for a moment. I am glad to hear it, very glad, says George sincerely. And perhaps that will help somewhat. Lawrence raises his eyebrows. George tugs at his tie. There's no good way to say it. There has been talk, Will. Talk? Lawrence repeats blankly. He has not been appearing in society of late. Unless it is his scarcity that has prompted censure, he can hardly imagine how he might be generating notice. George clears his throat delicately. It is known that you have moved away to live with your particular friend, he starts, and understanding hits Lawrence in a rush. Mortification follows, but George continues before he can say anything. And
Of course, I am glad for anything which brings you happiness in these days, George says, determinedly not meeting his eye. But there are concerns. That is, Mr. Tharkay himself, you understand, is not well known.
Lawrence blinks slowly. George is clearly grasping. Tharkay's lack of interest in society can hardly be the worst of anyone's concern about the situation.
In good fairness to Mr. Tharkay, he finds himself saying, since the festivities celebrating the war's end, few people have reached out to either of us regarding any social gatherings.
George pounces on the topic.
Then Elizabeth and I shall certainly host you both at our next dinner in July,
which is next month.
I will not hear otherwise.
Lawrence, fumbling, can only manage a confused agreement before George makes his goodbyes. Lawrence stares after him a long while before going outside to find Temeraire.
The dragon is resting near the stables and seems to have attracted company. Two lightweights are lying on top of his bulk and grumble when he sits up.
Lawrence, did something happen?
Lawrence is not unfamiliar, of course, with the sort of relationship to which his brother alluded. His early years in the Navy exposed him to such things, seen and heard by rumor and through the sort of tacit gestures which other men properly ignored. More recently, he has been confronted with overt examples. Even now, Captain Granby and Captain Little are posted together. They sent him a joint letter from Spain not so long ago. But he still finds an explanation hard to articulate. Under Temeraire's anxious eyes, he says at last, slowly,
George thinks I am a kept woman.
Temeraire considers this.
You are not a woman.
I do not think that matters, precisely, Lawrence replies. Pray, let us go on to London, dear. This day has been entirely confounding already.
After his conversation with George, the last thing Lawrence wants to do is speak with Persaitia on a matter which seems so suddenly and uncomfortably close. Naturally, she takes no heed whatsoever of his discomfort.
And you can be sure, she continues, that I have written to the good Captain Granby for his expert opinion on the whole thing.
Lawrence closes his eyes, makes a mental apology to the man, and resolves to write a letter as soon as he returns home.
Persaitia has built herself a pavilion outside Dover, like many of the dragons, but with her increasing forays into London, she has evidently seen the need for a second. Lawrence is somehow entirely unsurprised that the Duke of Wellington has connived to get her a placement in Hyde Park, just across from his own townhouse. That, he thinks, must be a combination to terrify all of their political rivals.
Temeraire himself is less than impressed with the pavilion. It is far too small for him, so they are all discussing the current issue on the grounds.
Poor Belusha seemed very disinclined to breed when I was in Penny Fan, and I quite understand why, if she did not enjoy it at all, Temeraire says. It is one thing to be awkward about the whole business, and if someone should say, no, I don't feel like that today. I do not think anyone should argue that two dragons should have to breed, except maybe that great lout Lloyd. So it seems very awful to me that people will say someone should do something they dislike, such as mating where it is not wanted, only for silly notions like propriety.
Temeraire feels apparently obliged to add.
At the time, I only thought Belusha was embarrassed about her gift, or felt she was not splendid enough for me. Of course, it is not just a problem of dragons, Persaitia continues. That is the thing. I do not think anyone really cares what two dragons do, or three or four.
Lawrence tries not to follow that train of thought.
But humans are oddly preoccupied about what other humans do, and they think it will start a precedent if they say we may have rights that they cannot have.
Rather, that they think people will argue for the same rights, Lawrence corrects.
But that is precisely the thing. I do not see why people should not, Persaitia says. This entire matter with Parliament would be much easier if only we had more support. And human support means much more than ours at this juncture, you know. There are far too many of you. It makes voting uneven, she adds severely.
Lawrence cannot think how to explain that finding public support for legalizing, perhaps recognizing, same-sex relations is less than likely. It would be political suicide for anyone who tried to support them. Only the king himself would have enough influence for the task, and maybe not even him.
It seems to me, Temeraire said, that there must be some of these inverts in Parliament, or among the military, who would be willing to help us. I mean, people who can really persuade others. Surely that would be a great help if only we could prove that it is no terrible thing to be with someone you like, instead of someone society approves of. Such people exist, Lawrence says. It is foolish to say otherwise. But they will not help you.
I do not understand humans at all, Presidia says.
I am quite certain of one thing. I am not going to let anyone hurt Belusa or Minnow or our other friends, Temerar adds. And certainly not over such a ridiculous thing as this.
Perhaps belatedly, Lawrence sends off his own letter to Granby, by courier, speaking of the problem in the vaguest terms possible. He expects no particular response, but neither can he express his confusion on this particular issue to his other associates without some expectation of reproach. Apparently, several local papers have featured the issue, discussing it as a problem of public values, which he finds difficult to understand. But then, he supposes, it is odd that anyone be concerned about the private lives of men, or women either. He returns to the Foreign Office on Monday. He is late, which is not his fault. Temeraire was waylaid by an excitable grayling who begged their help in moving a series of overturned wagons, and they lost yet more time when Lawrence naturally helped the travelers into the city. It is nearly 2 hours past his hour of arrival when he walks up the path to the office, only to be waylaid by a familiar face.
"Mr. Lawrence," Nastasia cries. "How very good to see you. I am suing," she adds.
Lawrence pauses, with one foot hovering on the steps to the office. "Well," he says.
"Not you," she corrects, to his great relief. He does not particularly think he has done anything worth legal action, but in recent years this has not seemed to stop anyone. "Those solicitors you recommended are marvelous. I just came," she tells him with a bit of mischief, "to brag about the whole thing to your office. I couldn't resist."
"I wish you the best of luck, madam." She smiles.
"Are you not late? You're working with the Japanese delegation, aren't you? I saw your books. They're inside," she adds.
Lawrence starts.
"The Japanese?"
"Oh, yes. That rude man, Longstaff, he was talking with them."
"Thank you," Lawrence says, and she nods as he moves past.
The clerk looks alarmed when he walks by. A small group of men are standing in Longstaff's office, the doors thrown wide open.
"His Majesty Prince Lawrence has heard your concerns, and would repeat that this stance will be reconsidered only once Japan has reciprocated, Mr. Tsukada."
Lawrence walks up behind the group.
"If more ports were open to England, we will both benefit, you must agree. You know, of course, that the Chinese have found our trade very beneficial."
"Mr. Longstaff," Lawrence says, speaking over several heads. He has never seen a man pale quite so rapidly.
"Mr. Lawrence," Longstaff yelps. The Japanese men turn around. "I would be interested to know when I have heard any of these concerns you mentioned." "I must have forgotten them all," Lawrence says. Longstaff gapes at him. Lawrence turns toward the nearest delegates. "I am afraid, sirs, that I cannot speak for anything that the King's government, or, more accurately, Mr. Longstaff here, has been telling you. In fact, it may be relevant to inform you that I am resigning from my post immediately. Good day."
"Mr. Lawrence," Longstaff insists. Lawrence has no idea where to find Temeraire at this hour, but he hasn't seen much of Edinburgh, and now seems like a good time.
"Somehow I am unsurprised," Tharkay says. "But I am sorry nonetheless."
Lawrence just nods and accepts the glass pressed into his hand. Tharkay watches him across the parlor's table.
"Quite honestly," Lawrence admits after a moment, "I am not at all good at speaking Japanese."
"I would honestly have been surprised otherwise," Tharkay replies dryly.
Lawrence has grown perfectly content with his life. And that is something he might have marveled at only a few short years back. It seems greedy, almost, to expect more, to tempt more. He sets down the glass.
"I thought to hang the sketch you made last week," he says, "from when we sat outside, you remember. But I realized I could not."
"I do not make a habit of art," Tharkay admits.
"That is not why," Lawrence pauses. "It seemed indecent, to put it in the hall. It seems like a private thing."
Tharkay looks at him for a moment.
"You could still hang it," he says at last.
"You have always been a part of us," Lawrence says. "And perhaps I was the one unable to understand it."
"I have never needed a picture to see, Will," Tharkay says.
Lawrence tugs at his tie. Perhaps he's been too bold. He stands abruptly.
"I'm sorry," he says. Tharkistan's as well. I should not have presumed. That is, perhaps it was a mistake. Tharki grabs his wrist.
Will, he says firmly, I will not be so patient if I must follow you around the world another 5 years before you have this epiphany.
That seems a bit unfair.
Well, if you have one first, I suggest you say so in the future, Lawrence sighs, wrapping his arms around Tharke's shoulders.
Tharke stares.
Yes, he says at last.
Perhaps I will do that after all.
It seems surprising that so many people care about the private lives of two dragons. The dragons themselves, Lawrence is sure, would not have thought twice about their mating. He is somehow recalled to an old conversation on the Allegiance, the thoughtful words of Mr. Erasmus. Dragons do not have original sin. But that is not the argument to take, he realizes. Not quite. By any standards, he cannot fathom what wrong was committed.
Lawrence receives a letter from Granby on just the subject. The poor girls are probably more baffled than ever by humans. You will forgive me my indecency in reminding you I perfectly understand. All this fuss is ridiculous, Will, and yet it must come to some conclusion now that the point is raised. I cannot imagine the country's dragons bowing down again. They are getting fond of freedom. I am damn glad to be still fighting, can I say that? Letting Iskir get the enemy will be easier than Temero's battle in Parliament, I think.
It is all based on your god, Temero says. God says this, and God says that, and if this god person will not come down from his place in the clouds to talk, or at least send a decent representative, I do not see why I should have to listen to him in the least, Lawrence. I have read that Bible thing, and it was no help whatsoever.
I believe there are representatives, Lawrence says. They are called priests.
And they do not agree on anything, Temera grouches.
It is your job to make them agree, my dear. I fear they are quite influential, despite your reservations. You may need their support.
Temera sighs loudly, his claws scraping the dirt. His tail flops dramatically against the hard-packed dirt. Nearby birds rise from the trees, shrieking in protest. Politics are difficult, he says.
You are more courageous than I to tackle that challenge, says a voice. They turn to see Tharke coming up the hill.
You are quite courageous yourself, Temera says generously. And I do not believe I can blame anyone for not wanting to talk to government.
You are government now, Tharke says, now sincerely amused. He draws up beside Lawrence, turns, and touches his arm. He takes Lawrence's elbow in hand and brushes a kiss against his cheek. Lawrence does not react. He can feel his face flushing, his heart beating against his ears. Tharke pauses.
If I misunderstood yesterday, he begins.
You did not, Lawrence says, and clears his throat.
It is only, it is, of course, illegal, he protests lamely.
Good God, as if you have done nothing else illegal, Tharke complains. Lawrence winces.
Forget society for once in your life, Will.
I could have pursued my father's lands at any time, you know. I pressed the case these past few years only because I hoped I might have reason to stay in England.
Lawrence exhales.
Temeraire looks between them with growing interest.
There is nothing more important to me than... And anyway, England has been no friend to us. If the laws are nonsense, as we know they are, why should we follow them?
This, Lawrence thinks, is certainly a fine thing to say in front of a member of Parliament. Although... Lawrence pauses, looks at Tharke.
Or, he says.
No, Tharke says.
Temeraire did mention that a symbol...
Tharke pulls away and rubs his head against his hand.
Do you seek out hopeless causes deliberately?
Lawrence catches his hand.
Tensing, he says quietly.
If you are so committed, we will change the laws, but we are not hosting any balls at the manor.
They accept George's invitation to dine at Wellington Hall. His brother writes back in a missive that cannot hide the man's relief. Lawrence has now been utterly absent from all social functions for months, and Tenzing, even more select in his friends, has not let himself be dragged out since the celebrations after Napoleon's defeat. A handsome canopy has been erected on the ground for the dragons, and Lawrence is somewhat touched to see the half-finished work of a large communal pavilion in progress. George had not mentioned it in his letters, but Temeraire makes pleased noises over its function, and the whole thing is clearly meant as a gesture. It almost makes Lawrence regret what he is about to do.
George opens the doors personally when they arrive at Wallerton Hall, likely alerted by the shadow of Temeraire overhead. Lady Allendale is outside receiving the dragons, and half the party's on the lawn. Will, Tenzing. He gets a good look at them.
George, Lawrence says, thank you for having us.
George's smile turns a bit brittle.
You're going to cause a scene, aren't you? He asks.
Lawrence is wearing his blue coat. For this event, he is nearly underdressed, but the occasion seems fitting, and even Temeraire agreed. But George is looking at his arm, linked closely and deliberately with Tharkay's.
Scotland is getting very boring, Tharkay deadpans.
George sighs loudly. Let me head off, Mother, he says, and get Mr. Antwill drunk first, please. He will only cause a scene. Then you may do what you like. He vanishes into the main hall. Through the door, light streams out, and distant echoes of laughter drift through the opening.
There would always be rumors, Tharkay says. But are you certain of this?
Lawrence looks back at the doorway.
I think we have been cautious for far, far too long.
Tharkay nods. And together, they step through.
The end.